This week, we welcome Tim Woods, Vice President of Technology Alliances at Firemon, to discuss how to navigate the complexities of policy and compliance in hybrid clouds. In the leadership and communications section, 10 signs of a good security leader, toxic leadership, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, know them, 3 ways to take control of your cybersecurity career in 2022, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly.
How have business drivers impacted your organizational risk? Simulate Extended Security Posture Management enables CISOs to know what parts of your cybersecurity portfolio to keep, what to get rid of, and what to buy. Know that your cybersecurity investments are optimized and can reduce cybersecurity risk. With Simulate, you don't assume you are secure, you know. Visit securityweekly.com/simulate to learn more.
Endpoint security is designed to protect every device in your fleet, wherever it may be. These days, that can be a lot of different places. Find out how HP Wolf Security uses emerging strategies like application isolation, along with a zero-trust approach and framework, to give you a powerful, manageable, usable solution to your growing and increasingly spread-out security challenges. Learn how HP Wolf Security can make a difference across your endpoints at securityweekly.com/HP Wolf. Cyber risk and compliance automation is finally here. Legacy GRC systems cannot support the powerful, real-time automation and oversight that organizations require to take risks that matter to succeed. CyberSync continuous control automation ingests data from the IT GRC stack to update controls against regulatory requirements and risks in real time, delivering insights and visibility. See how members of the Fortune 500 are saving millions annually by visiting securityweekly.com/CyberSync.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 259, recorded April 18th, 2022. I am your host, Matt Alderman, now from Texas. I got my Texas flag this week because I needed something on this wall. Joining me remotely are my co-hosts, also from Texas. First joining, Mr. Ben Carr.
Hey, Matt. How's it going? Good to be with you here on a fine Monday. Weather's warm. Texas is welcoming you. Happy to have you.
Yeah, it's a little cooler up north today, but it was beautiful yesterday for Easter. It was just a gorgeous day. Also joining, filling in for Mr. Albuquerque, is Mr. Tyler Robinson from Idaho. Welcome, Tyler.
Thanks, Matt. Happy new Texas house. We're going to have to get you a nice gun list going, I think.
Yeah, I brought a few with me from Colorado, but I think I'm a little light, so I'll need to get a few more.
Yeah.
Security Weekly listeners save $100 on your RSA Conference 2022 full conference pass. RSA Conference will be live in San Francisco June 6th to 9th in San Francisco. Security Weekly will be there in full force, delivering real-time live coverage and interviewing some of the event's top speakers and sponsors. To register using our discount code, please visit securityweekly.com/RSAC2022 and use the code 52UCYBER. We hope to see you there. Do you have any specific guests or topics that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and completing the form. We review suggestions often and will reach out to you once reviewed. This segment is sponsored by Firemon. To learn more, please visit securityweekly.com/Firemon. Tim Woods brings more than 20 years of security experience to his role as Vice President of Technology Alliances at Firemon. His global engagements have given him great insights across virtually every market sector and enterprises of all sizes. Tim believes his most important task is education and raising awareness to build strong organizational security postures. Tim's passion for security grew quickly during his 8 years serving the naval intelligence community and continued to advance as he assumed strategic roles at several successful security startups and through his 14-year tenure at Firemon. Tim, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here, Matt.
Now, we're going to talk about some of the complexities and challenges of what I call policy and compliance. During our prep call, we were talking a little bit about vulnerabilities and misconfigurations and compliance. A lot of people on this show know I'm a huge proponent around configuration management and how misconfigurations lead to a lot of attacks that don't necessarily get the same press coverage as vulnerabilities and other types of attacks. And what we're going to do now is kind of apply this into a hybrid cloud context. I think you talk about ground to cloud, but before we go ground to cloud, let's just talk about some of the challenges around just like this expanding perimeter of cloud environments and hybrid cloud environments.
Yeah, I mean, the you know, visibility is key, right? Today, probably more than ever, you know, as this hybrid landscape continues to expand, the perimeter is definitely blurred. If it wasn't already blurred enough, you know, it's blurred even more now. And of course, along with that is an enlarged threat landscape. And so you couple that with just the sheer amount of heterogeneity, you know, from on-prem, in the data center, at the remote offices. And now you get into SD-WAN, you get into SASE, and then all the way up into your cloud provisioning. And all along that way, there's all these policies that can help you, you know, secure your environment. But you got to get your arms around them too. If you're going to manage them appropriately and maintain the hygiene in those policies, then you have to have the visibility necessary to do that. You have to understand policy behavior. You have to apply some analytics and some analysis to those policies to ensure that they're doing what you want them to do. And then that, in turn, of course, gets applied to both your business posture, your security posture, your compliance posture. All of that just works hand in hand. But yeah, definitely a bigger map that we're looking at today.
And it's not that the tools don't exist. I think the challenge is there's too many tools. And it's like, which tool should I use? And how do I get insight across and visibility across all the tools? Because each of the cloud providers, for example, have a way to set up and configure their environments. But if you're running multiple clouds, that creates a challenge because now you have multiples of those tools. And then you have your existing on-prem, your remote workers, and all the other challenges. So it's not a lack of tools as much as it is like an integration of all the different tools, isn't it?
It's a consolidation of the information, right? Rather than jumping around, because you're right, there's native management tools from the top to the bottom as well. And we hear it all the time is we're trying to consolidate the information so that we have better visibility to the things that we need to react to or the things that we need to respond to or the things that we need to remediate. But when we're, and now back up just a second to also say that it's been our experience that there's quite a bit of, I guess, for lack of a better word, security fragmentation of responsibility. So it used to be that you had kind of one team, one security IT team that was responsible for everything. And today with this expanded hybrid infrastructure, you've got DevOps, you have the business owners, you have the traditional IT security team, you have new cloud security teams that are emerging as well. And so there needs to be a little more coordination. And it doesn't seem like that we're singing from the same hymnal. We're not and so trying to coordinate all that as well and bring all of that into a common lens so that you can properly analyze what's going on, again, from a perspective of looking at your security posture and your compliance posture, becomes a bit, quite a bit more of a challenge. So, yeah, definitely. Again, as that hybrid landscape continues to expand, getting your arms around the security of that is important. We like to say it's really hard to secure what you can't see, and it's hard to manage what you can't secure, obviously.
Right. Yeah, Tim, it's really been a presentation of choices, right? Up till now, I think that, you know, as a CISO, I struggle with, you either get great visibility into, you know, a holistic solution, or you have to sacrifice, you know, and not get that visibility, but actually get more of a best of breed tool set or, you know, instrumentation on, you know, those different environments, whether it be on-prem, cloud, hybrid, DevOps. It's that's really been the challenge. And so I mean, I'm always looking at solutions where we can use those best of breed solutions, but still get the visibility to it.
Yeah, Ben, and we hear a lot also from the CISOs that they're trying to drive greater efficiencies into the things that they have. Matt was right. I mean, there's a lot of tools out there, and you can have the best technology on the planet, but if you don't manage it effectively, then of course you're not going to recognize the return out of the security investment that you're looking for. Yeah. But then that goes back also to your people having the time to do that. We hear it all the time from CISOs, like, I have my best people kind of bogged down or doing a lot of repetitive, monotonous, mundane tasks, and I'm trying to free them. I'm trying to put more cycles back into their day so they can focus on the higher skilled activities that we brought them on board for to do in the first place. And so they're really trying to, it's not that I don't know what to do, it's having the time and freeing my resources to do it.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, Ben, to Tim's point a little bit, like the fragmentation of who owns what. I mean, if you think about certain environments, the ability for the DevOps team to spin up a piece of infrastructure in the cloud, like who's responsible for the enforcement of policies at that point? Like, how do security teams know that that's happening? How do they get visibility into that to know whether those pieces of infrastructure even being spun up and secured properly? You know, that's part of this fragmentation that I think is a challenge in these hybrid cloud environments.
Yeah, it's super hard. I mean, we're really faced with a big challenge with trying to figure out how to get an understanding of what's happening, when it's happening, and who's doing it, right? I mean, it is, as you say, as it moves more into DevOps and we're trying to extend the capabilities out and allow people to do stuff in a more timely fashion, makes that really, really challenging and hard to do and hard to get perspective from a CISO perspective.
So then my question to Tim is, all right, how do we start to solve this? If the complexity's increased, the attack surface continues to increase because of the way the perimeter has just moved to be pretty much everywhere or nowhere, whichever way you want to put it, and fragmentation. So how do we get our arms around these challenges? How do CISOs need to think about to bring all this stuff together? Like, is it a federated, centralized system of policies that are then used to manage to give you that visibility and manage change across those environments? Is it? I want to say that simple, but I'm not sure that that's very simple.
Yeah, from a Firemon perspective, I think one of the greatest values that we provide is, you know, from a visibility standpoint, is of course number one, looking at change. When change happens in the environment, and making sure that you are in a position where you can analyze that change, answer some very basic questions about the change. You know, did I expect the change? Was the change documented? Did that change have any type of negative impact to my business posture, security posture, compliance posture? And if the answer to that is no, and then that falls into compliance as well. You know, almost every regulatory compliance initiative that you look at, I mean, one of the first things they ask is, are you monitoring for change? And if not, do not pass go. Do not collect your $200. But real change analysis, I think, is really important. And that gets right back into visibility and it gets back into compliance. But it also gets into risk awareness and understanding that your policies are not doing things that are risky. But if I stepped back for a second and kind of painted a bigger picture, it would be one of just looking at the complexity. You know, so we talk about that expanse, that hybrid expanse, and what we're really talking about there is this growth in complexity. Kind of has been pointed to. You have a lot of things, a lot of people doing a lot of things, and things are getting a lot more complex. And so if we're not challenging that complexity, that growth in complexity. And complexity comes in many forms. You know, from a policy management perspective, just the sheer number of rules that we're required to manage across that environment is growing. the applications and the resources and the assets that are getting deployed and making sure that the proper security controls are attached to those things. You know, that's a form of complexity. But what we know beyond a shadow of a doubt is if we don't challenge complexity in our environment, then a couple of things are going to happen. The probability of human error, the probability of risk, the probability of misconfiguration is going to take place. And so we need visibility. We have to be checking for change. We have to be actively real-time looking at change that's taking place within our environments. But we also have to challenge complexity within these growing environments in order to maintain that complexity gap. And if not, the security debt just kind of builds up.
How do we challenge that complexity? And then once we've validated that the complexity is necessary, how do we continue to move forward with that strategy outside of, you know, a lot of companies do need the complexity in which they're building into that just because of the technology that they're using or the business needs mandate it.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And so when I talk about complexity, I'm really talking about the unnecessary complexity that creeps into the environment over time. You are absolutely 110% right. There's an inherent amount of good complexity that goes into any good security implementation. But the complexity that I'm talking about is the unused rules. It's the unused objects. It's the overly permissive rules that's providing way more access than what is necessary to meet the needs of the business in these environments. And if you don't manage the hygiene of your security policies, especially as those rules are growing and as the heterogeneity and the policies themselves are growing across this hybrid infrastructure, that's where we get into trouble. That's where security gaps start to appear. So no, you're right. There's an inherent amount of good complexity, but there's also a lot of just unnecessary complexity, technical mistakes within the policies. It's not uncommon, just to put things in perspective or to give you an example. When we engage with a new client, it's not uncommon. And we start to look at, let's say, one of their particular enforcement points, maybe one that's 3 or 4 years old, which would be considered today would be considered legacy. And so anytime I say legacy, I use the term very loosely because a lot of these policies, a lot of these rules that even come into the newer enforcement point deployments are the rules have been there for a couple of decades. It's interesting, but it's not uncommon for us to engage with a new client and find anywhere between 40 to 50% of their rule base unused. Whether those rules have just become dormant or stagnant, or they're technical mistakes, or they're redundant, shadowed, duplicate, whatever. There's just a lot of unnecessary bloat that has happened in these policies over time. And that can represent inadvertent access. It can represent unnecessary risk, especially when you get into the overly permissive rules that exist within the enforcement point technologies.
So do you think that there is a way for us to actually successfully deploy and achieve a zero trust model? Or is this why, you know, your guys' software is so successful? Because we have that ongoing hygiene that is always going to include legacy and continual business adaptations that, you know, may introduce change and always are going to introduce change, and thus that zero trust is almost a pie in the sky idea from what I've seen. I'm curious what your thoughts are around some of that.
Number one, I'm a proponent of zero trust. I think there's a lot of different technologies that you can bring to bear on, you know, a zero trust implementation. Obviously, it's a guideline. There's no standards driving zero trust today, but having good policy hygiene, especially whenever we talk about the hybrid landscape and all the policies that you can bring to bear on creating what I call zones of control or segmentation, and whether that's, you know, macro or micro segmentation, at least I want to be able to use, I want to understand where those security, almost everything has a security policy today. You know, when I look at the SD-WANs, the switches and the routers and the load balancers, not just the firewalls, there's so many things that we can use from a security enforcement point perspective to build good solid policies to enforce our smaller zones of control or more defined zones of control. that can come into play for zero trust. And then you combine that, of course, with identity access management and some of the other things that you use that are very important to building out a zero trust infrastructure, and making sure that you can share and exchange. And then we get into a discussion around APIs, you know, for the platforms that I'm using. How open are the APIs? What's the commitment of the vendor to having a very robust set of APIs that's going to allow me to share, enhance, enrich, and exchange information with the other security solutions that I have so that I can raise the total value of my combined security solutions, especially in a zero trust environment? So if you're trying to boil the ocean with zero trust, you're probably going to fight an uphill battle before you start. So I think you got to find where you can define those pockets of success and go from there and build it out slowly. And of course, set your goals, set your higher goals of aspirations for a larger zero trust implementation. But you can't start out trying to boil the ocean with zero trust, that's for sure.
Yeah, when I think about the core domains of zero trust, network being a core component, that is one place to start. But you mentioned identity, you've got device, you've got the application cloud side, and ultimately at the data layer, right? So you're right. When you bring all five of those domains together, it also adds a lot of complexity on top of any one of those. And we're talking on the network side.
Yeah. Now, when you think about the data, where the data is stored, data at rest, data at motion, endpoint as well, you know, all of those domains in their own respect can contribute to, you know, a solid zero trust implementation. But you just got to take one of them at a time. And I think everyone has to be in sync about what they're trying to achieve. Also, if you don't define your goals and what it is that you're trying to achieve up front, everybody's trying to roll their own, then that's going to be a problem also.
Right. True. So you talked a little bit about monitor for change, talked a little about APIs and integration. Is there an order? Like, where do you start? Is it as simple as just doing basic monitor change? How much do you have to have integrated? You know, there's a lot of talk about right-sizing investments, consolidating your vendor stack, building out these more holistic integrated ecosystems. How much of that ecosystem do you have to have in place before you can do some of the basic monitor for change in this environment? Like, where is that balance and what's the order?
Well, you have to have a solution that scales to the size of the environment also, right? That's when I talk about having the best technology on the planet, that's one thing. Managing it effectively, of course, goes hand in hand, but then also that technology has to scale to the size of the environment to make sure that it's well adopted. And again, that you recognize a return on that investment that the company is making. I'm sure Ben can relate to that. The last thing Ben wants to hear is shelfware for any of the solutions that they acquire or deploy. But I think it starts with for us, we want to monitor as many of the security devices as possible and bring those security policies into a common rule repository so that once we get all of the rules, we bring all the rules in and we normalize those rules in this normalized rule repository. And once we have everything in this repository, then there's all kinds of things we can. You know, it drives our rule searches, it drives our rule and behavior analysis, it drives understanding, being able to overlay vulnerability scan data on top of the rule base so that we can understand if we have risky rules or if there's a particular event going on in the environment. I'm not running all over my environment from platform to platform to platform to try to analyze what my liability is. I can go to one centralized rule repository to do my searches. Let's say a new cert comes out that has some new nasty APT or some polymorphic virus and it's attacking a particular high port. I can go to that rule repository, run a very quick search, and in under 5 seconds across my entire infrastructure, I can come back and see if I have any rules on any of the devices that are providing the enforcement, or any of those open to this particular, you know, high port or processing, either in or out. So things like that. But for us, it's once I get the policies, once I bring one of those security enforcement technologies under the umbrella into my common lens, then I can start monitoring for change. So that just kind of happens automatically and naturally. But the next thing is to get that policy in there so that I can start doing some really, really good things as it relates to rule evaluation and policy evaluation with the various policies. And the more policies we get in there, the more policies we have to visualize, the better. But I think it starts with change, starts with that's going to give you the visibility, and then you're going to be able to focus on the hygiene of the policies that you have, which i.e. I'm talking about cleanup.
Right. Yeah. So I want to go to cleanup next, because the big, you know, the big terminology here is SOAR or automation. Like, what's the next evolution? If I've got the information, I find an issue that needs to be remediated. You know, where are we from an automation and launching playbooks and kind of allowing systems to take that next action? Are you seeing much movement there, or are we still pretty early in the automation side?
No, it's more than you might think. I mean, we're seeing a lot of interest just on the Technology Alliance side of it, and of course, which is my general responsibility at Firemon is the relationships that we have with the other technology companies that we integrate with, and we're doing that with SOAR. We're doing that with the XDR platforms, and we're doing that because we implement understanding when a change happens and analyzing the policies and stuff, but we also have the ability to push policy, to modify policy. And so we can integrate as a component of a playbook on a SOAR platform or on a XDR platform and help to be that component that instantiates a new policy or modifies a policy on one of the other enforcement point technologies to prevent something bad that's going on within the environment. So there's a lot of, but it goes back to what I said earlier. Also, it goes back to having a good, robust API that allows you to integrate with these other security solutions that you brought into your environment as well. That should be an easy process. As long as you have that robust API and you can exchange information readily with those other solutions, then you should be able to extract value from both platforms together. Kind of 1 + 1 should equal more than 2.
Yeah, and if you can't get some basic automation, you know, that hopefully solves one of the challenges with getting your security folks to work on some of the higher level stuff, because they're not so worried about implementing rule changes across, you know, 40, 50, 60 firewall devices or whatever the number might be.
That's right. You know, and having good hygiene also, if you're migrating from one platform to another, you're trying to migrate even from within. Today, we support about 80 different technology vendor relationships and permutations of different vendor products within our ecosystem, Alliance ecosystem. But even, you know, going back to having a good clean rule repository or having a good clean rule base, if you ever try to migrate that to something, you're carrying it from legacy into the cloud, or you want to make sure that you, when I talk about that bloat or I talk about that unnecessary complexity that creeps into the policies over time, you just don't want that. You don't want to have, it's no different than if you're moving. And Matt, you'll relate to this. It's no different than if you're moving domiciles, right? You probably, you know, before you start packing things up, you're going to have a garage sale. You're going to give some stuff away to charity, and you're probably going to throw some things out because you're not going to want to take the stuff with you that you don't need. But if you've ever tried to move a rule base from one platform to another, even within the same vendor, or if you're transferring, or if you're migrating from one vendor platform to another, you don't want to have to take the time to migrate those things that you don't need. Number one, it's very costly, and number two, it eats up your it's an extreme resource impact as well.
Yeah, I just heard a new business model. Put all this information, all your stuff in your house in, and prioritize what you keep, what you move, and what you get rid of. Yes, because we did all of the above, Tim. We sold some stuff. We donated a bunch of stuff. You threw a bunch of stuff away, and you packed up only and moved what you wanted. So yeah, I understand it. Yeah,
it's a great analogy.
Ben or Tyler, any last questions for Tim while we have him?
No, I think I'm good. I think that was a really good discussion. It's always something that's challenging to figure out how you get consistency across, you know, that rule based understand what you have, what the impacts are to the environment. So, I think that was a really great discussion.
Awesome, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Pleasure talking with everyone, guys. Hope to see you at RSA.
Yes, you will. If you want to learn more about FireMon or how to gain visibility into your hybrid cloud environments, please visit securityweekly.com/FireMon. We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more. Cyber criminals are working overtime. Last year in the fourth quarter alone, phishing attacks disguised as COVID testing information increased by 521%. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cyber criminals use them to steal money from your company or personal information from your employees and customers. Find out about the 13 email threat types and how Barracuda can provide complete email protection for your teams, your customers, and your reputation. Get your free ebook at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. It's time to rethink how we approach cybersecurity, because the reality is modern cyber attackers are already past your initial defenses. ExtraHop helps your security team find and eradicate advanced threats before real damage is done. Protect your enterprise and customers with better defense. Learn more about how ExtraHop stops advanced threats at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. That's extra H-O-P.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Ben Carr and Tyler Robinson. Don't miss any of your favorite Security Weekly content. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to any of our podcast feed and have all new episodes downloaded right to your phone. You can also join our mailing list, Discord server, and follow us on social media and our streaming platforms. Join Alan Stasilauskas and host Tyler Robinson and Paul Asadorian on April 21st to learn how to gain visibility into your enterprise with Sysmon. Also, join Paul Asadorian and Rich Mogul on May 4th to learn how to choose the right architecture for your application. Live attendees at both of these webcasts will have the chance to win a $100 Hacker Warehouse gift card. Register at securityweekly.com/webcasts. And don't forget to check out our library of on-demand webcasts and technical trainings by visiting securityweekly.com/on-demand. All right, gentlemen, time for the weekly articles. Now, articles were a little light last week. It was kind of an extended holiday weekend. We had Passover and Easter, and not a ton of articles came out. I was scraping the barrel a little bit to find a couple. But this first article from Gartner, the headline caught my attention: cybersecurity, we need to talk. It's an interesting opening line statement around, hey guys, what are we doing in the space? Like, here's some guidance. And Ben, I don't know if you're use Gartner or not for some of your research and data, but there's a couple really interesting points they highlight in this article around technology and investments and some other things. I was curious how it resonated with you.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting reading through the article. I guess, you know, a lot of these, you know, cyber insurance eligibility, I mean, we've talked about that a bit, right? You know, business operations, regulatory demands. I mean, I think a lot of this is kind of commonplace stuff. I have used Gartner in the past. I'm not really using them right now. I guess it's, you know, look, everybody needs to have a wake-up call that this is a top-level risk. And again, I think, you know, it's funny, like, it seems like recurring themes. We talk about these same things. So I don't think any of this should have been a shock to anybody. I think, you know, thinking about the Ukraine and whether there's impact to supply chain, obviously that's something that's a newer event. But most of this is pretty typical. I didn't see a ton of stuff, but I mean, I think there is a wake up at the board level and at the ESTAF level that if this is one of the top risks on your matrix, then you really should be trying to figure out how to address it.
Yeah, I like the first bullet. When it breaks down, it says organizations must stop investing in security tools and start investing in outcomes. Think about that for a second. Like, now vendors would be like, no, keep spending money on my tools. But right. But I mean, in reality, if this is about risk and a business risk, then think about the outcomes you want to achieve and then work back to identify which investments you need to make, right? Where I'm not sure everybody thinks that way. They think about, wait, I got to make a bunch of security investments before I know my risks and outcomes I'm trying to achieve.
It's a backward process, though. Right. I mean, like, ultimately, I think what people need to think about is what capabilities are you investing in? Don't make the mistake of then transitioning a capability into a tool. A capability is, you know, the ability to actually address an issue that you have, right? And that should always start with people, followed by process. And at the very end, what's the technology that enables all that stuff to happen? But how many times have, you know, I think, you know, my peers or, you know, people that I've worked with, I've talked to them and they've started out with, well, let's go get a tool and then figure out how to map it into the process. Just a horrible approach.
Right. Yeah. We were talking at the end of the last segment last week. At the end, there was some interesting dialogue about some technology choices, but that's because Jason went through a very specific process to evaluate capabilities he needed to meet outcomes, right? To the point is once he knows what he wants, then they can go out and evaluate technologies. And he made some interesting, you know, his team ended up making some interesting choices. We're not going to talk about what they chose, but it was the right approach because they knew what they needed to achieve an outcome, then chose the tool, not the other way around.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if you've been in the game long enough and you've done this and you've stayed current with technology, as you shift from one job to another job, it may look to outsiders that sometimes the CISO or, you know, a director or manager is picking a tool, but they've already done the evaluation of, you know, what is the capability I need? And they've maybe, you know, looked at a bunch of different tools to figure out, all right, this is the best one that's purpose fit for what I want to do. But at the end of the day, I think you still need to look at that in terms of what the resources are in your current role and make sure that you can actually implement that capability effectively. Because again, if you start out with the tool and just try to slap it in and think you're going to get value out of it, I think that's, you know, we mentioned shelfware earlier. I think Tim said, you know, last thing I want is shelfware. I think you end up with a lot of shelfware because the expectations are what the vendors say it can do. But have you matched that up with your ability to deliver that capability internally in your organization?
That talent to tool matching and the capability and talent grooming also plays a big role in how you actually deliver on that strategy. And I think that's probably one of the biggest benefits and outcomes of not getting shelfware is by identifying what your real capability is and being very honest with either bringing in additional resources, training the current resources, or evaluating the talent that you have and then matching the capability and tool set to that group. That makes a big difference.
Yeah, it ties a little bit into this next article, the 10 signs of a strong security leader. Now, these are not security specific, by the way. These are just 10 signs, in my opinion, of a strong leader in general. But when you apply it to security, you start to think about what Tyler just said. You know, people process, having well-documented processes, and understanding some of your skill sets and your talent, right, play into strong leadership identity, but also back to the previous article around, you know, making the right investments for outcomes. I was not shocked by any of the 10 really on this list, but there are some that I think are really important for people to understand, which is, you know, be pretty open and transparent. You know, answer any question directly, right? Just certain things that, you know, that if you're getting straight answers and people are answering questions, they're not deferring and they're being proactive and making timely decisions, you know, you're in the right place. Like, you just kind of know it. And it's a good environment to be in. When you don't see those things, that's when you create a lot of internal angst, and it's not good for an organization.
Yeah, man, I echo the thoughts. Like, when you said that these aren't just good security leaders, right? These are leaders in general. And that's what I thought. Like, when I read this, there was nothing that stood out to me as like, you know, it doesn't apply to something else. I mean, I think these are just good traits to have as a leader. But I think the other thing to look at is, if as you're grooming your team and building your team, like, look for these traits in the people that are in your team, or how you incentivize these traits. And I'm a big believer in that. You get what you actually incentivize out. And so, to turn this into something from a security perspective, you know, everybody expects vulnerabilities to be remediated. But at the end of the day, from an operational side, if you're not, you know, putting in your MBOs or your KPIs, things for those operational leaders to then make sure that they're patching and fixing and remediating, you'll always have a disconnect. So incentivize the behavior you want to get at the end of the day. And so I think if you look at these traits and you look for things that you say, What do I want to incentivize? I mean, make sure that you're not letting things go through whether or not well documented. Make sure that you're actually highlighting, you know, when people's actions don't match what they're articulating. Make sure that you're actually nurturing and promoting talent yourself, so your people see that and you will nurture and promote talent within their lower level of the organization. I think that's really the key, is to make sure that you're aligning this to the goals and the strategies that will ensure long-term success for your org and for the company.
Yeah, and KPIs get interesting in goal alignment. This is a thing we've been working on more internally this year, because I'm a big believer in identifying those right KPIs and then making sure that they're in the individual goals. So you bring up a really good point. If there is a disconnect there, that is a leadership gap, right?
It is.
You've got to have goals aligned for the employees and the employee base to meet the key performance indicators you want to measure the business on. And it's not always that easy, Ben. I think the challenge for some organizations is, you know, which one, you know, do you have the right set of KPIs, leading and lagging indicators that are helping you drive the business? And it sounds easy, but it's actually a little harder than that to actually do, to make sure that you're setting the right goal alignment for your employees. Then you see that alignment. Then you know things are in good and much better shape.
Yeah, and that's why I think people shouldn't look at KPIs as static. They should look at KPIs as something that's a target state. But if you realize it's off, you need to think about potentially resetting those to align to what you can actually deliver on. And I think KPIs should be something, and you know, your MBO should be something that you're saying, okay, this is what I think that it may be a stretch. It may be not easy to get to, but it's attainable, right? Given a set of circumstances. If you make it too difficult or too easy, then those goals become somewhat useless, right? I mean, you're trying to, again, incentivize that directional behavior to move your team and the company in the direction you want to achieve. So if that direction isn't achievable, it's unlikely that you're going to get people really committed to that goal without being disheartened and, you know, disengaged at some point.
I'll give you a really good example, because I have one. If you want to grow your audience for the podcast, for example, I wonder why that would matter. Then one of the goals could be to get bigger name guests and talent on to interview on the shows, because that would create interest across the audience to drive more stuff. See, that's a very logical goal alignment to a potential KPI around audience growth, right? So to your point, you didn't make it too hard, but you didn't make it too easy, because it's not easy to go out and find these, you know, these larger names to agree to come on to the podcast, for example. But we are stretching the limits of who traditionally would come on. So, I mean, these are real life examples, because these are things we talk about all the time internally.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point.
Yeah. Is your organization ripe for a reorg? Oh, sorry, Tyler. I skipped you.
No, you're good. My internet had a little delay here, but I was going to say that kind of ties into your next story, though, with the reorg and what KPIs and capabilities you have internally to match or meet those stretch goals. I don't think stretch goals should be something that you should not attempt to attain or strive towards, but sometimes you have to think outside of your organization and think about the strategic alignment of who you need to get in order to reach one of those larger stretch goals. And that means bringing on talent, bringing on capability, and having the right people in place to do that. And sometimes that is a reorg.
Right. Yeah, it is potentially. I'm curious, Ben, from your perspective, like you just got to a new organizational structure.
Sure.
I mean, did you do a reorg or like how do you approach an organizational structure when you go on? I'll share my story in a minute, but I'm curious from your perspective, like when you go into a new organization, how much are you thinking reorg, or are you thinking let things kind of stay static in the near term?
Yeah, so that's a complicated question. I think, you know, any CISO or any C-level exec, or, you know, when you go into a new organization, one of your thoughts are, I have to see what this looks like and see if it's, you know, is the reason why it may be underperforming, if it was underperforming at the time. Is the reason the people? Is it the process? Is it the leadership that was there? And all those things are really viable answers, right? So I think my approach is typically, and what I approach it here is, come in and understand the org and understand the team and understand if I have the right talent. And it may be, and I like to think about a reorg a little bit more generically, maybe. It may be that the reorg is just moving people around, right? Or giving people additional challenges or opportunities. So I think a lot of people get kind of complacent in their role. And so that, you know, can breed a lack of interest. And so once you start seeing that, I think, you know, maybe it's time to shift. Maybe it's time to maybe move your SecOps person to attack surface, or your GRC person over to, you know, some other role. And shifting those roles around, or certainly from an IC side, giving those individual contributors different opportunities within the org can really invigorate it. Now, sometimes you do have to go in and say, all right, this isn't fit for purpose, or I have a build here. I've got open holes or open gaps where as we grow, as we transform the business, that we have openings and we need to kind of stretch or change the org. But I don't like to go in and say, you know, I'm coming in, I'm going to change everything, because that's not really giving the current org the due diligence to understand what's actually broken. And I think a lot of people who come in and have that attitude find that, you know, 6 months, 12 months later, they're in the same situation. It's still not working, but that's because they're not building correctly.
Right. Tyler, any thoughts on this one? I have one story to share.
Go ahead.
So, and, you know, as most people know, you know, when we got acquired a year and a half ago, I was trying to figure out like what happens, right? And so when you get acquired and think about all the different acquisitions that are going on out there right now in different areas, this is another opportunity to potentially reorg. But when do you do it? What's the right structure? How do you approach it? So yeah, Ben, to your point, right? Yeah, we got there, did initial integration, but we made slow changes, right? We made a couple little adjustments here. But as we got into 2022, we started thinking about shared responsibilities. What are the things that are shared across the organization? Because for us, with three different business lines now, there are things that transcend the three different lines. So where do you put it? Do you put it in one, or do you create a horizontal team that goes across? So what we did here is we actually created horizontal teams for certain activities that spanned all three business units, and then put you know, the focus of the business units into the three business unit leaders. Now, there's pros and cons to this approach. And I wanted to use this article to talk about it a little bit, because the pros are you get more efficient shared resources across the organization. The challenge, in my opinion, is you also lose some of the insight and the ability to influence change in those horizontal groups from the business unit side, right? So I own the P&L, but I don't own most of the resources that contribute to the P&L. And so that creates a little bit of a challenge in those types of structures. So just think about when you're reorganizing your staff, think about you know, crossover, but also think about, you know, what are the challenges from each of the little vertical areas when you have kind of these cross-functional teams? And I would imagine they exist in security as well.
Yeah, and I think I look at that as more, are you trying to implement almost a shared services model, right, in some instances? Right. And I think especially in larger organizations where you're doing acquisitions, so, you know, you think a very large multinational, but you require really agile subunits, like it's a different business model for those subunits to operate in. But from a security perspective, one of the things that, you know, like when I was at Visa or, you know, Nokia, one of the things I was always concerned with is how do you make sure that you're implementing good security controls and process for all those smaller units you're acquiring while not stifling their, you know, agility. And so in order to do that, I think a shared services model works well, where you say, okay, we're going to manage this at a bit different level across the horizontal, but then we'll give the individual responsibility at those business units to do specific tasks or functions that are more suited at that individual business level. So it's almost a hybrid approach, but I think it can work well depending upon, you know, what the scale of the organization is.
Right. Next article, Toxic Leadership, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, Know Them. Really good article for leaders. Like, these are the four things you should like never, ever, ever do. If you want to keep your employees happy and you want to keep them there, otherwise they're going to go find a job elsewhere.
Well, it's that truism about people don't leave jobs, they leave leaders, right? So yes. this is if you see one of these four things, you're likely looking to run. So if you see this in a manager or somebody in the company that has a leadership role, figure out how to get it addressed quickly.
I think these are kind of no-brainers though too, right? Like often we have to realize that some of these are masked as other, we'll say other traits that are not ideal, and often they get brushed under the rug, or they're taken as a personality, or they're just, you know, looked at from a business standpoint, and you're taking that business risk because you have other positives. But if you actually dive into some of these and look at the underlying problems with how these portray themselves and how they come out in other traits and not just these root cause or root problems, you can also address those minor traits and potentially get ahead of it. But these are, you know, these are the no-brainer pieces of this with a lot of subtle hints underlying that you do have to keep a handle on with inside your leadership, but also for yourself.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I think these are good things for even leaders to kind of look at and evaluate themselves against. You know, things like, so for example, some people could say I'm a little arrogant at times. I think I'm confident in certain decisions and capabilities I make. I'm not sure that I'm arrogant, but some people could say I might be a little arrogant, but I'm not dishonest. I'm one of the most forthright, open, transparent people. I just ask anybody on my team, like, I probably tell them too much information because I rather have that open, honest, transparent dialogue with my staff than lie or try to hide things from them. It's just not my style. It never has been. I'm also not a micromanager. So things like manipulation and a lot of those other things, just, it's not my leadership style at all. So, like I said, arrogance, you know, somebody might call me that every once in a while.
No, knowing is half the battle, Matt. As long as you're aware of it, you can change.
Exactly right. Yes.
I mean, in that borderline, there are some of those traits that you have to ride that edge very, very carefully. And to be really good at some of the things you do need that confidence. You do need to be a good leader. You do need to have the ability to influence people, which can come across as manipulation. So I would say some of those traits have to ride the line and have a positive and negative connotation. You kind of have to figure out where you're at.
Exactly.
And right. I think that's actually a challenge in, you know, when you think about people you've known before, because I think we've all know somebody who exhibits one of these traits in a negative way and keeps moving up the chain, but nothing ever gets done about it. We all question why. And I think that's, you know, because in, like, you know, they mentioned arrogance, you know, sales, that it could typically, you could see that in somebody in sales. And I think that's very true, right? It can be a somewhat positive characteristic trait in some salespeople. I think in a lot of people in security, they're arrogant because they're really good at what they do, right? And so you could see that as arrogance, as Matt said, but it's crossing that line, right? And I think we need to have that honesty in ourselves and with other leaders of the company to say, hey, we're having an issue here. We need to address that before it becomes a problem, right? And it gets out of hand.
Right, for sure. Which leads us into this next article, how to persuade your staff for change. Two approaches identified in this HBR article. I like both of them for very specific reasons. So what it talks about is a couple of the different techniques to implement a change within the organization. The first technique is what they call the foot in the door technique, which is let's try to do a little small change on the way to a bigger change, right? Which works in certain organizations, right? We kind of make incremental change steps to implement something a little more major from a change perspective. And when you're in a technology company, this kind of approach works, right? Because you're thinking about an agile kind of environment, life cycle, things move, making small iterative changes to reach a big outcome usually makes a lot of sense as a technique. The second technique is called the slam the door in the face, I think is what it's called. Door in the face technique, which is, and I like this one because I think this is the one I have to use where I am today. You have to like make such a drastic change where everybody rejects it and then they accept the change you actually want to happen. Like, think about that.
It's perceived as reasonable. Yes, you make something unreasonable exactly right. to then propose the reasonable change. I think we're all used to doing that with budgets.
Isn't that exactly like what Putin's right. doing right now? Like, is that what?
Maybe. Yeah, he's so unrealistic that he's looking for, you know, some middle ground, in the next few weeks. But that approach is really interesting because you really push the envelope. You don't really have to go that far or want to go that far, but then you get them to buy into what you actually want them to do. I'm more the believer of the first one, but I guess you did bring up a good point. Budget's always one where you want the door in the face technique.
Yeah, look, if you haven't read the book, Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss, who is the lead, I think FBI hostage negotiator, read that book. Like his take is like always go for more than you think you want, because at the end of the day, like you're not trying to settle on something that's going to make, you know, both people unhappy, and it's the psychology behind it. So I really recommend that book. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
As a leader, that psychology stuff becomes more and more important. You have to be able to influence people. You really do have to understand the different personality traits and how to work with them, especially when you're talking about this. The change piece really was something that I think was hard for a lot of people that were in tech early on. You kind of get that old curmudgeon-y way of doing things they know. So you have to kind of figure out how to maintain those people that have that institutional knowledge and that really great skill set that provides huge benefits to the company, while also giving them a way in which to adapt and not end up in a cycle where you're stuck in something. And that is because of so many people that are, you know, institutionally there for a while, that change becomes inevitably impossible. Those are two things that are hard to play out, but that's where the leadership comes in, and you use the psychology and the understanding of people and doing that in an elegant way is what makes really good leaders happen.
Well, it aligns a little bit with that. Are you ready for the reorg article, right? Because I think ultimately, at the end of the day, like how many times have you ever heard going into an org where you're new and it's like, that's not the way we do it here. Okay, so we're just going to keep continuing on with a broken method, right? Now, the challenge as a leader is to come in and say, okay, is it really broken? Like, what is the reasonable change we need to do that's going to get to the right place for the company and the end result? And how do you bring people along on that journey? How do you articulate a vision of where you're needing to go? Message that out appropriately, and then get buy-in that people will start going on that journey with you. Because I think the worst thing you can do is put the stake in the ground for change and you haven't got anybody's buy-in. Yeah, you're going to fail.
Yeah. Miserably. Yes. Last article, 3 ways to take control of your cybersecurity career in 2022. Couple practical advices. We've covered pieces of this before. It's kind of a succinct article. The first one really is around just practical experience versus formal training, right? We've talked a lot about training programs, certifications, not always a requirement or the best way to get your foot in the door. Practical experience, getting that experience though can be challenging, right? It talks a little bit about apprenticeships and some other things that you need to do. And then it does talk about fellowships and boot camps. I haven't seen much in the way of some of these boot camps and areas, but it talks about some of the challenges with the higher level, you know, courses. That's why I don't recommend to people that want to get into the space to go out and buy one of these big like boot camp certification programs, because I don't know that they extract the value out of it at the end of the day.
Have you ever run across somebody you'd hired because they went to a boot camp, Matt? Like I can't remember a time. Like I don't even know if somebody who'd say, hey, yeah, I went to this boot camp and it was a great experience. Like there's, you know, I'm sure there are some people it works for, but I haven't run across it. It hasn't professionally been something I've seen to be impactful. So I would much prefer that somebody goes and gets practical experience. And, you know, people say, well, how do you get practical experiences, you know, if you don't have any experience to start with? Well, figure out something that's an adjacency, right? I mean, it's what we look for product. How do we move product out towards an expanding set of skills? We look for an adjacency and we slowly move in that direction, usually, as opposed to that big bang approach. So look for something that's easier to break into where you can get some experience that's adjacent to it. You can tell a story about how you have tangential experience that can move you into that role and where you had successful things that happened in the role you had. And if you can lay out that story, I'm much more willing to take a risk on you.
Yeah, I mean, Jason shared great stories from the past of, you know, of folks from the IT side of the house that had the adjacency skill set and had the interest in cybersecurity, ultimately moving into cybersecurity. So to your point, Ben, getting some practical experience could be help desk experience, could be, you know, some IT service operational experience, something that gives you some of that foundational capabilities and experience in the IT adjacency space or something like that is a way to get in as you show interest and aptitude around cybersecurity, for example.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, we typically, you know, somebody who's somewhat in the industry, right? So, you know, I know people in my life who have, you know, kids that are thinking about, you know, cyber careers or things in the space. And, you know, I always tell them like, look, if they're interested, let me know and I can reach out to people and see if there's things that they can do. And it may not always be in the cyberspace. It may be, you know, especially if you're in that position, hey, I'm willing to do whatever. I'm willing to do a help desk role, as you said. I'm willing to do something in the IT side of the house. Like, just let me get my foot in the door, right? And then show success, like build that track record that you're successful in what you do. And I think ultimately you'll find the path.
I mean, I think that's one of the best pieces of advice that I try and divvy out when people are interested in getting into it or they think the job's cool, is really providing them that shortcut track of things that have helped me in my career that are not typical. You can always go do training, certs, boot camps. Those are great. Honestly, if you spent some time learning operations, learning a niche space like ICS or OT, getting in on a help desk so you understand all the platforms and user troubles, and then really learn communication, business, and all the business lingo, like you do those things first, you're probably 90% more valuable once you pick up the small percentage of security things to any organization you go into, because those are the things that are missing.
Some, you know, some PHP, some Python, some scripting, some coding. You never know where it might get you.
Well, I love Tyler's suggestion about ICS, right? Like somebody who actually has practical experience in OT or ICS, then trying to get some security chops add on to it to be able to go back and say, okay, well, yeah, I do understand some security, but I can actually tell you why you wouldn't want to do that in an OT environment. Super valuable, right? So look at for those opportunities because they exist.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of came out of that space spending, you know, a good chunk of my early career in nuclear power, right? I mean, I was working nuclear power, real-time plant systems, and some of the challenges there. Did it translate 100%? No, but it was a good adjacency skill set because as OT became hot, I started to understand the foundational elements around safety concerns and plants and organizations and why you probably not want to go patch one of these devices or potentially take it down to patch it because there were other ramifications of these devices, right? And so, you know, there are other areas like that, plant managers, for example, and others that have if there is some crossover with IT in those environments, there is a really good solid foundation to potentially address some of the security concerns in those environments as well.
That's another point that you just made there, Matt, that has served me really well over the years is don't ever take for granted anything that you're learning. Wherever you're at, try and learn the most that you can, because you never know how far down the road that information may become relevant or useful from a red team standpoint. Like learning about printers and how multifunction copiers were deployed in mass to organizations 15 years ago now plays a huge role into my red team. Like I know all the default codes, how they're managed, how they're set up and configured, what the kind of pipeline and sales process is. So if you're in a sales role, you know, understanding the back end sales CRM, all those little things that you learn along the way pay
dividends. Tyler lost his internet again. Darn it. But he makes a really good point. All that knowledge potentially can come back and help you later, for sure. If Tyler comes back, Tyler, thank you for stepping in today for Jason. Ben, always a pleasure. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.